Niedermann had not intended to stay long at the brickworks. He thought he would have to lie low only until the initial police manhunt had died down. He shaved his head and let his beard grow to half an inch, and that altered his appearance. He found a pair of overalls belonging to one of the workers from Norbyg, which were almost big enough to fit him. He put on a Becker's Paints baseball cap and stuffed a folding ruler into a leg pocket. At dusk he drove to the gas station shop on the hill and bought supplies. He had all the cash he needed from Svavelshire MC's piggy bank. He looked like any workman stopping on his way home, and nobody seemed to pay him any attention. He shopped once or twice a week at the same time of day. At the shop, they were always perfectly friendly to him. From the very first day he had spent a considerable amount of time fending off the creatures that inhabited the building. They lived in the walls and came out at night. He could hear them wandering around the workshop. He barricaded himself in his room. After several days he had had enough. He armed himself with a large knife, which he had found in a kitchen drawer, and went out to confront the monsters. It had to end. All of a sudden he discovered that they were retreating. For the first time in his life he had been able to dominate his phantoms. They shrank back when he approached. He could see their deformed bodies and their tails slinking off behind the packing crates and cabinets. He howled at them. They fled. Relieved, he went back to his room and sat up all night, waiting for them to return. They mounted a renewed attack at dawn, and he faced them down once more. They fled. He was teetering between panic and euphoria. All his life he had been haunted by these creatures in the dark, and for the very first time he felt that he was in control of the situation. He did nothing. He slept. He ate. He thought. It was peaceful. The days turned into weeks, and spring turned to summer. From his transistor radio and the evening papers, he could tell that the hunt for the killer Ronald Niedermann was winding down. He read with interest the reports of the murder of Zalachenko. What a laugh! A psycho put an end to Zalachenko. In July his interest was again aroused when he followed the reports of Salander's trial. He was appalled when she was acquitted and released. It did not feel right. She was free, while he was forced to hide. He bought the Millennium Special issue at the gas station shop and read all about Salander and Zalachenko and Niedermann. A journalist named Blomqvist had described Niedermann as a pathological murderer and a psychopath. He frowned. Fall came suddenly, and still he had not made a move. When it got colder, he bought an electric heater at the shop. He did not know what kept him from leaving the brickworks. Occasionally, some young people drove into the yard and parked there, but no one had disturbed him or tried to break into the building. In September, a car drove up, and a man in a blue windbreaker tried the doors and snooped around the property. Niedermann had watched him from the window on the upper floor. The man kept writing in his notebook. He had stayed for 20 minutes before he looked around one last time and got in his car and drove away. Niedermann breathed a sigh of relief. He had no idea who the man was, or what business had brought him there, but he appeared to be doing a survey of the property. It did not occur to Niedermann that Zalachenko's death had prompted an inventory of his estate. He thought a lot about Salander. He had never expected to see her again, but she fascinated and frightened him. He was not afraid of any living person, but his sister, his half-sister, had made a particular impression on him. No one else had ever defeated him the way she had. She had come back to life, even though he had buried her. She had come back and hunted him down. He dreamed about her every night. He would wake up in a cold sweat, and he recognized that she had replaced his usual phantoms. In October he made a decision. He was not going to leave Sweden before he had found his sister and destroyed her. He did not have a plan, but at least his life now had a purpose. He did not know where she was or how he would trace her. He just sat in his room on the upper floor of the brickworks, staring out the window, day after day, week after week. Until one day, a burgundy Honda parked outside the building and, to his complete astonishment, he saw Salander get out of the car. God is merciful, he thought. Salander would join the two women in the pool downstairs. His wait was over, and he could at last get on with his life. Sullender assessed the situation and saw that it was anything but under control. Her brain was working at high speed. Click, click, click. She still held the crowbar in her hand, but she knew that it was a feeble weapon against a man who could not feel pain. She was locked inside an area of about 10,000 square feet with a murderous robot from hell. When Niederman suddenly moved towards her, she threw the crowbar at him. He dodged it easily. Sullender moved fast. She stepped onto a pallet, swung herself up onto a packing crate, and kept climbing, like a monkey, up two more crates. She stopped and looked down at Niederman, now 13 feet below her. He was looking up at her, and waiting.
"Come down," he said patiently. "You can't escape. The end is inevitable."
She wondered if he had a gun of some sort. Now that would be a problem. He bent down and picked up a chair and threw it at her. She ducked. Niederman was getting annoyed. He put his foot on the pallet and started climbing up after her. She waited until he was almost at the top before she took a running start of two quick steps and jumped across an aisle to land on top of another crate. She swung down to the floor and grabbed the crowbar. Niederman was not actually clumsy, but he knew that he could not risk jumping from the stack of crates and perhaps breaking a bone in his foot. He had to climb down carefully and set his feet on the floor. He always had to move slowly and methodically, and he had spent a lifetime mastering his body. He had almost reached the floor when he heard footsteps behind him and turned just in time to block a blow from the crowbar with his shoulder. He lost his grip on the knife. Sullender dropped the crowbar just as she delivered the blow. She did not have time to pick up the knife, but she kicked it away from him along the pallet, dodging a backhand blow from his huge fist and retreating back up onto the packing crates on the other side of the aisle. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Niederman reach for her. Quick as lightning, she pulled up her feet. The crates stood in two rows, stacked up three high next to the center aisle and two high along the outside. She swung down onto the two crates and braced herself, using all the strength in her legs and pushing her back against the crate next to her. It must have weighed more than 400 pounds. She felt it begin to move and then tumble down towards the center aisle. Niederman saw the crate coming and threw himself to one side. A corner of the crate struck him on the chest, but he seemed not to have been injured. He picked himself up. She was resisting. He started climbing up after her. His head was just appearing over the third crate when she kicked at him. Her boot struck him with full force in the forehead. He grunted and heaved himself up on top of the packing crates. Sullender fled, leaping back to the crates on the other side of the aisle. She dropped over the edge and vanished immediately from his sight. He could hear her footsteps and caught a glimpse of her as she passed through the doorway to the inner workshop.